Welcome to Two Teas in a Pod. I'm Kate Diaz, a Manchester math teacher and elected president of CEA, the Connecticut Education Association. We are Connecticut's largest teachers union, representing tens of thousands of professional educators across the state.
And I'm Jocelyn Delancey, a fifth grade teacher in Darien, elected vice president of CEA and president of CEF, the Connecticut Education Foundation, CEA's charitable arm.
In every episode, you'll hear thought-provoking interviews, as well as actionable tips and strategies that you can implement in your daily life. We'll have stimulating discussions to help you become a more informed and effective educator and advocate for your students and the teaching profession.
Thanks for spending some time with us today. Now let's jump right into Two Teas in a Pod.
Well, today, Jocelyn, we are lucky. We have one of my favorite people, Kristen Basiaga. She is the president of the Glastonbury Education Association, which, as you know, is a neighbor to Manchester and highly competitive to our association. But we'll play friends today. How's that?
That sounds good.
All right. All right. We're halfway through the legislative session. Today, we want to kind of get in and talk about what it is that you are excited about, how you plan to kind of rally the troops, use your voice to hopefully help us push these things over the finish line. And, you know, no pressure, but if you could just inspire a few people to want to get on the bus with us, that'd be great.
Maybe just one or two.
All right. Well, we'll take whatever you bring to the table. So welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And so, Kristen, I think one of the things that we're really interested in is, from your perspective, what are some of the things in there that are really exciting to you or that you think would make the biggest difference?
I think the pandemic pension credit has to be up there, and that's the one that my members ask me about the most. They ask me for progress, how's it going? Just this recognition that the work we did through the pandemic got not only teachers and students back to school, but it allowed parents to go back to work and get our economy bustling faster. Recognition for teachers and all the risks they took in their classrooms to be taking care of all these students. I think that would be really meaningful for educators to get that appreciation from the legislature this year.
I agree with you. And I want to just kind of go on the record, because one of the things we hear frequently about is that it doesn't currently, in the current proposal, really reflect the people who are close to retirement or have already retired. And I want to go on the record in saying that we have actually been advocating for some inclusive language, some space to add that in, because I agree with you. And we frequently talk about the fact that teachers did an extraordinary effort to go virtual, learn to teach in dual instruction, which is bad. It's all bad. Never, ever think that that's okay. We did what we had to do during a pandemic. And then we are still continuing to manage the impacts of trauma, mental health challenges, all of those things that will likely continue and be pervasive in education for the next probably 5, 7, 10 years.
Right. And, you know, one of my coworkers who is retiring this year was my physics teacher from when I was in high school, Mr. Moss, who's now at Glastonbury with me. But, you know, he worked through the pandemic right alongside me. Right. And there's no reason that he should be excluded from this pandemic pension credit just because he happens to be retiring this year, whereas right. other people are retiring in 3 or 4 years. So I'm really glad that CEA has been advocating for including language for our imminent retirees that also work through the pandemic with us.
Yeah. Well, and I think that it sends a message, right? It sends a message that we appreciate our educators no matter what space that you're in. We appreciate mm-hmm. you for the time that you've put in. We appreciate you for the time that you're going to put in. And we appreciate those people who are just entering saying, listen, when things get tough in our state, we know that we can count on our teachers. And we will support you through that. And I think that that's what approval of the pandemic credit will do, is say, as a state, we respect, appreciate, and thank our teachers, all groups, for the work that they did during that time period.
Exactly, exactly. Because that is one of the things that my members were asking about, is they're like, is it true that retiring teachers are excluded in this language? But with any luck, you know, the legislators will look at it and make the recommended adjustments.
And I think this is a point that is really important for our members to kind of advocate for as well, because our legislators only know what they know, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is a space where we can educate them, we can offer them different perspectives, offer them voice of, listen, it what you're doing is great, but it is missing, you know, I always talk about the teacher who already has 37 and a half years and right. is still teaching. It excludes them too.
Yes.
And so I think there's a whole opportunity for us to speak to this issue, educate our legislators, and really help push this to be a full complement for our membership. But let's talk about things that aren't money necessarily, because that's also, I think, you know, we have teacher evaluation pieces. We have stuff on standardized testing. We have stuff on play, kindergarten start age, 30-minute prep guaranteed, duty-free. I mean,
there's just so abundance many
of things. What do you think would make the most difference to your members?
I think it depends on what field they teach in. Sure. A lot of our elementary educators, they don't get 30 minutes of prep per day. They get a certain amount per week. So the idea that every single day you're guaranteed 30 minutes would be a really big boon to them, because I can't imagine doing what our kindergarten teachers do, which is, you know, on Wednesdays, they don't have a specials. They only get their 30-minute lunch, and all the rest of that time is just hands-on with kids all day. And I think that's incredible that they do it, but I don't think that they should have to. I think that the 30 minutes of prep will allow them the time to plan better lessons or coordinate with special ed teachers and, you know, really do the best that they can for our students. So, you know, as to avoid burnout, and I think that would be extremely helpful for them.
Right. Well, if you don't take care of the teachers, they go away and you have no one to take care of the children. Right. So there is a care aspect to this, the acknowledgement that we should be building systems that support the workers in them, not abuse the workers in them.
Yes, I like that point, that if you start putting so much on teachers' plates, they're not going to be able to take care of themselves or their students. So
That's
one of the things I'm hoping with the 30 minutes of daily prep time is something that they'll consider.
Has your super raised any, like, concern about this? Because I know we're going to hear, like, this is impossible. We're going to end up, you know, cutting instruction. And that's often the sort of superintendent response of...
I have not. And I think part of it is because, you know, Glastonbury already has more than 150 minutes a week of mm-hmm. prep time, but not every district does. We have language that's prep time must occur in at least 25-minute increments, but it's not every day. So it would really be minor changes to the schedule, but administrators could work that out without significantly changing instruction.
Yeah.
I think it's important, too, for the teachers who don't necessarily have a kind of scheduled prep time within their field, right? So as an elementary fifth grade teacher, mm-hmm. I got prep when my students had their special, because that's just the nature of an elementary school classroom teacher. Right. But if I were a special education teacher, I don't have that prep scheduled. So if I have IEPs throughout the day, if I have testing hours that I have to do for evaluating students, and then I also have to cover my caseload, there could be a full day where I don't actually have any time to sit, prep, and do the work that would help support my students. So I think making sure that all educators, no matter what position right. you're in, have that prep is even more important, because we do unfortunately sometimes overlook those people who have significant caseloads and other services right. that don't have those natural prep situations.
Yeah, like your speech and language pathologists right. and your school psychs and social workers and school counselors that do all these things for our students, and they don't have language that says what their prep time clearly is.
It's permissive, if nothing else, right? Exactly. It allows those people who have more, where they're self-scheduled, I guess is probably the term, mm-hmm. right? Where they have kind of are constructing their own, you know, organizational. It's permissive in reminding them, no. You have to put a carve out for 30 minutes.
Right.
You know, you have the right to do that. So I think there's something really important for that.
Well, I think that's the truth about most of the policy language that we have here. I've heard the concern that some of these are unfunded mandates or you're just adding something onto the plate. But with a lot of the policies within the legislation this year, they're not necessarily mandates. They're the state taking a stance of saying, this is the right condition. Mm-hmm. This is the right work. Yeah. These are the right things we should be doing for our students and for our teachers. Because again, I've said this so many times, our teaching conditions are our students' learning conditions. And so for the state to take a stance and say, these are the things that are important and that are going to matter, I think would go a long way in having districts secure those permissions for educators.
Yeah, I think we can't afford to not make change. And like when we talk about this, I always try and remind people that there, every change has cost, right? Maybe mm-hmm. it's opportunity cost, maybe it's financial cost, time cost, whatever it is. But we can't afford to not make big shifts right now. Because when I think about this, you know, in the fall, 74% of our teachers said, you know, I am really considering my options here. Mm-hmm. If 74% of our teachers think about leaving, we can't make that up.
No.
So I view this in many respects as a high stakes negotiation. And we've got to do something that takes 74% of our teachers and makes them rethink that decision. And that's not going to be with small efforts, right? It's going to be, think about the teachers you've had who've said like, I'm out, I'm done.
Right. And there have been so many of them that were never considering leaving teaching, that loved their jobs. And, you know, after the pandemic and seeing, you know, the new change and the new normal, are just ready to throw in the towel. And I think companies and corporations have started actively
yes.
recruiting teachers. I probably get like, you know, an email or so per week that's reminding me that Electric Boat is hiring
yeah.
people with physics degrees, that, you know, people are looking for
unhappy teachers who want to make more money.
Right. Coming up the pipeline, there's also not a lot of people going into education,
right.
probably because of what they hear about how teachers are treated, not just in Connecticut, but in the whole country.
Well, you hit on a really important point. We have to look at this legislative session as an opportunity to shift the narrative, right? Mm-hmm. Right now, the narrative is pretty rough.
Yes.
Come join us. You're going to make $40,000 a year and everyone's going to pick on you.
Right.
Yay!
Well, and I think, Kristen, you're such an active advocate for this work and really pushing our legislators to kind of shift the narrative to make Connecticut a pioneer in what public education can look like and should look like. Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that you're doing as an individual, as a union leader in your local? What are some of the things that you're doing to communicate with our legislators and support this agenda so that our voice is heard loud and clear?
Yeah, so I wear a lot of hats. so I live in Cromwell, and one of the things I did about a week or two ago was I spoke at the Board of Finance meeting and encouraged them to pass the budget without additional budget cuts, because they were already cutting 4 teachers and 3 paras, and the Board of Finance wanted to make additional budget cuts, and they were saying, well, you know, that might not cause more teacher layoffs, but whatever you cut from the budget is going to be cutting from my daughter's education. So I was wearing the parent hat in that role, speaking as a resident of Cromwell.
And you were paying attention.
Yes.
And I think that's the other piece of it, right? Like, don't let those opportunities be things that you hope somebody else does.
Exactly. And if you leave it as just a Facebook comment or, you know, some reply on social media, that's not really the same as taking the 5 minutes to go to a meeting, say your 3-minute piece, and make sure that the people who are making the decisions know what it's like to be a parent in Cromwell or to have a student
right.
at those schools. So on the union side hat, I think one of the things I have to be careful about as a union leader is making sure that what I'm saying reflects what my members actually feel. So early in the year, we sent out a survey with a list of potential priorities, and we asked members which they identified as their most important. Mm. That way, when I speak, I know that I'm going off input from my teachers, and I'm not just going off my personal opinions. So the, you know, 4 things on the top of their list, pandemic pension credit was up there, class sizes was up there, the pension tax, those were all things that I know my members have asked for. Teacher evaluations was one of them.
Yes.
That was in my top 4. So I made sure to do my homework that whatever I was saying was absolutely 100% reflective of what my members at large wanted. And it's not that they didn't think kindergarten start age was important. It's just that fewer numbers of my members marked
right.
it as their number 1.
Right.
I'm pretty sure my kindergarten teachers marked kindergarten start age up at the top.
Absolutely.
But when you have 500 members, you want to speak to the whole group. So.
Yeah. And that's a huge responsibility in terms of, you know, messaging. And mm-hmm. what we want to do is as a leader, you have that perspective mm-hmm. of how do I share where the mind is of my people. But it also is important that each individual member feel empowered to say, Kristen's got us on that. I'm going to make sure kindergarten start age gets spoken about. And we really did start to see that with the hearing for 6884, there had over 600 pieces of testimony submitted. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was individual teachers saying, this is important to me. And that is powerful.
Yes. We had one of our, I think, first grade or kindergarten teachers at Button Ball wrote in a letter in support of the kindergarten start age and was explaining, like, if you have a four-year-old who's expected to take all these standardized tests, it's not play. Like, you know, we grew up thinking, like, I have a distinct memory of kindergarten, like, playing with pudding on a desk like, eating the pudding.
Those fine motor skills were really important.
I was great at fine motor skills. But that's not what they're doing in kindergarten anymore. Kindergarten's the new first grade. So this member wrote great testimony in support based on her experiences in the classroom and was able to send that in as written testimony. If you can write a short essay, think like three paragraphs tops to get your point across.
These legislators, and they do read them. That's an interesting part is as we talk to them, they actually do read these narratives and they care a lot about personal experience. So my favorite thing about this is to remind people that you don't need to be an expert in anything other than yourself, that you know enough based on your experience to talk about these issues. And so if you are a kindergarten teacher or a first grade teacher and you have some sort of story, something to tell that helps illustrate why this is important, that goes a long, long way. And interestingly enough, I was talking to a legislator who hasn't heard from anybody. And I thought, as a matter of fact, I went back and I was like, we need to send somebody, you know, a message that this legislator who sits on the education committee had not heard from their constituents. So they do pay attention. And it's really important that we remember that, that to your point, the 5 minutes you show up at a meeting, the 10 minutes you take to share your story, send an email to your legislator. And you can always find that information on our website. Or you can just go to the CGA, the Connecticut government website, and it's super easy to find our legislators.
Well, and I think that what's really important that this is a really long session, and we're kind of right in the middle of it. We still have a few months for our members to get out there and tell their stories, have a back home meeting with their local union, reach out if you live in one town and work in another, which is what you were just sharing.
Yes, you get double dipping.
You get to speak to those both. And I think that that's something that's really important. We still have a number of opportunities through CEA to get involved in this session. We have our lobby day on April 26th.
Coming? I'm coming to lobby day. So I do know that a few of the other teachers from my local will be going. Very excited. We have someone taking one of our association days so they can be there for the morning session.
Oh, love that.
Oh, that's excellent.
It's Miles. So you'll see Miles.
Yay, Miles. So I think that, you know, the more people that we have coming out together in that group, I think will be really very telling for our legislators to say this matters not just to the union, but to all of us as individuals, as parents, as educators, as, you know, people who
taxpayers, voters.
You know, we really need to see this move forward. We don't have an option not to. So I think that there are still so many opportunities for us to really fight this fight and get these wins for our not only our teachers, but for our students.
And I hope people see Lobby Day as not all work, because I think there's a moment about this that's a real celebration. We get to get together and advocate and to feel empowered and to feel like we're part of the process that allows us to make the case for change and growth and for the potential and to really celebrate our contributions as educators. We have a ball. So, you know, I think it is enjoyable. It's a really unique experience, but you really do feel like you've contributed. And you don't have to be an expert. That's what I keep telling people. I'm like, there's no expertise required.
Just show up and tell your story, because I think people would be surprised about the things that legislators don't know about.
Oh, they don't know.
There's a lot they think they know, and they want to make a difference, but they'll only know as much as the last constituent told them. So I think we have to make sure that our constituents are the ones who are out there sharing our stories and telling them what will make a difference.
There's a lot of people with opinions.
Right.
I will say this. There's a lot of people with opinions about public education. A lot. What there's lacking is a lot of people with experience in public education. And so I think, and we do have people who want to make good decisions based on the experience of the people in the classroom. So we have the space to fill, and somebody will fill it. So it's whether or not it's going to be our voices.
And I think one thing about the lobby day that I think would
can
be
you tell
really,
we're excited about
I am
lobby
so
day.
I'm so excited. I can't excited wait. About I had so much day. Fun last year.
We but really did have
I
fun.
Think one thing that if you can't come up to Hartford, which, you know, living in Stamford, I know that sometimes is a little bit of a schlep, although I think it's worth it. I think it would be so great if our teachers across the state wore their Red for Ed shirts or their yep. play shirts and, you know, took
email
group photos.
Email your legislator.
Email your legislators. We're all here together in, call you know, whatever town you're in. Right. Or a call, you know, let's all get together. We'll make some phone calls and make sure we leave our messages. Let people know that it can be a lobby day where we're here in person. And I think as many people we can get here, the better. But I think if you can't get here, there are other ways that we can use that day as a show of support. And I really hope to see a lot of social media out there with our teachers sharing their support for this legislative session and the work that we can do.
There's a moment of empowerment that we're really trying to seize. People are thinking about education, talking about education. We just want to keep them focused on the things that we know will make a difference.
Right. Because they might want to do something or make a change or write a law that's really helpful, but then it turns out when it goes into a classroom setting, they didn't think about the consequences, like the reading legislation.
I was right? just thinking, what could she possibly be talking about?
Maybe the reading
maybe
legislation.
Maybe the reading legislation.
Right.
So, yeah. So I do think you're absolutely right that we have the frontline experience to think about the consequences of these thoughts and to also kind of help people understand that the consequences is not all as dire as, like, there's this impression, for example, like starting kindergarten start age at 5 will cause this tremendous issue with 4-year-olds not being able to go to school. And to that I say, you're creating one problem to try and solve another. And we need to still protect those 5-year-olds. And I would also argue that sending a 4-year-old, giving them a horrible launch to their educational career, does harm for years.
Right.
That sometimes we never back out of.
Right. And then I remember, so my daughter was born in November. And so when we were making the decision, do I send her at 4 or send her at 5? You know, we talked to her preschool teacher and they were like, you know, she's educationally, academically ready, but socially, it's going to be really rough. And a lot of districts they don't hold kids back like they used to.
They don't at all.
Yeah, they don't. But what they'll do is they'll provide special education services. They'll do things to help students along. But if it's just, you know, wait an extra 8 months until the maturity is there, instead of having to supplement with services for years and years and making the kid feel like they
don't measure up.
Exactly. Like they're not as good or not as capable as their peers.
Right.
You know, that's a tough thing.
Well, and on this, because I always feel like when we talk about this, it's important to talk about a really serious fact. Connecticut is the only state that does a December 31st turnover for being 5. We are it. The next closest states have October 1st birth dates.
Yes.
So we are a holdout to an old, old, old practice that everybody else has backed away from.
There's a reason.
Yes,
and that
there is.
Will have lasting implications later on, right? I think when we think about the kindergarten start age, we're thinking about kindergarten. But we forget what that looks like in 5th grade. And then again in junior year of high school or senior year or when they're going off to college and they're 17 when everybody else
correct.
Is 19.
18 or 19.
Yeah. So I think mm-hmm. that these are the things that we see for like almost with blinders on, right? Right. Exactly
very
where
tunneled.
We are. Very tunnel visioned instead of looking at the implications. I taught 5th grade for a long time. I've had countless 5th graders who, you know, waited, and I have had countless 5th graders mm-hmm. who started early. I have never seen a 5th grader who kind of percolated an extra year before starting kindergarten who was really suffering or struggling, right?
Right.
It was always the kids who started too early that ended up having some social, and right. it wasn't always academic. It mostly was the social, emotional, but the social emotional strength
that's
and wellness needs to be there in order right. for a 5th grade child to be successful. And so I think that those are the things we kind of forget about.
Well, I will say this. We're both high school teachers, and yes. I kind of concur. Like, there's no harm that I've ever seen to the student who's a little older, and there right. has been challenges for the kid who's a little younger.
Right, so. Just a little bit less emotional maturity. Maybe they're a little bit less responsible. They're just not there yet.
Some of the habits and things, yeah.
So what I'm seeing is that we could probably talk about this legislative agenda and the issues on it for, I think we could probably go for another hour.
Right?
But I think what's
really... No one will listen, but we could do it.
We are pretty entertaining, so maybe they'll just subscribe to the podcast and we'll make it into a series.
There you go. We'll bring Kristen back.
We absolutely will. But I think what's really important is that we won't get these wins, so to speak, in this session unless members like you, mm-hmm. like other local leaders, like individuals pushing forward and sharing the story and pushing the narrative with us. So we need to do this together. So I want to personally just thank you, Kristen, because I know how active you've been and how supportive you've been of this work and how vocal you are. Your members should feel very lucky to have a leader like you. So I just would like to thank you. And also for all of you listening, let's get out there. Let's show what needs to happen in order to support our public schools and our teachers.
Absolutely.
And our students.
So we could run down things they can do. You could write emails. You can make phone calls. You can come to Lobby Day. If you're not going to physically show up to Lobby Day, you could wearing red for Ed. You could use that time within your own building or with the other teacher friends that you have, because we all have teacher friends. It doesn't have to be a big concerted effort. But
do a little virtual lobbying.
You could, right? But as long as we get our voice out there, it doesn't need to be hours of your time. It doesn't need to be like sitting waiting for a hearing or something like that. You know, anything that you can do as a teacher to help move this agenda forward for our planning time, for our pandemic pension credit, for the class sizes, mm-hmm. for play-based instruction, for reduced standardized testing. Anything that you can speak to as an expert, as an educator, would be amazing.
Awesome. Kristen, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward
to
continuing this work with you and to continue kind of fighting the good fight, so to speak. So thank you, and we'll see you at Lobby Day.
Lobby Day.
We want to thank all of our members for all you do and for listening to the latest edition of Two Teas in a Pod.
For more education talk, subscribe to Two Teas in a Pod and find us at cea.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Like what you heard? Share a podcast with your friends and colleagues and spread the word, because we are
stronger together.